Season 5, Episode 6, Dead Man Talking. It opens up with Sipowicz and Simone showing up to a crime scene where a small boy, a baby basically, and a mother were shot dead, and the husband was shot in the gut but was still alive. They presume it was a home invasion. When they check out the room, well, the apartment, there's not a lot of sign of struggle or ransacking. At one point, Sipowicz said, "How is this guy alive with his kid dead?" There's not really a whole lot to go on with that. It's just they pull that guy out of the room, and he's going to Bellevue.
And it's Sipowicz giving one of his upset, like being upset over a kid being killed.
Yeah, he's giving a lot of hedgehog faces, or warthog faces, I guess.
Not warthog faces, yeah.
Like, it's pointed because he has that moment where he looks down at the kid and is like, look at his little legs. But that's basically it. Because the family's name is Angelo, and I don't have the husband's first name. I just have Mr. Angelo's.
Paul?
Is it Paul Angelo's? I know the mom's name is Tina.
Tina?
And I don't...
I think it's Paul because I'm looking at the cast list that I have, and there's only a Paul Angelo's.
So it must be Paul. Anyway, that's the beginning of the episode that we go into the theme song, and this is
NYPD Blue Balls,
where I, Kirk, and the other voice, Kyle, go through every single episode of the best show ever, NYPD Blue, and this is the theme song to NYPD Blue. When we come back from the break, they're in the hospital trying to get some information out of Angelos. He says he doesn't remember much, just that he was in his house around 5 a.m. He thought he heard something downstairs and acknowledges it could be his son, because his son has some health issues. Then he sees a guy, he gets shot, and he loses and regains consciousness, but didn't see the guy.
And didn't see anything that happened at all.
No, and he says...
that's what he's saying anyways, sorry.
Yeah, he says he didn't see anything at all, and I don't know. It's one of those things where you're not sure if he's just a bad actor or he's playing a person who's a bad actor.
I'm on the other side of this. I think he's... Well, I mean, you gotta wait for the end of the whole episode, but I think he's doing a good job as an actor being the he's doing a good job being the character, I think.
He's doing a lot of posturing, as I would say, in the hospital, saying, like, I couldn't have saved them, there's nothing I could do, I couldn't see anything, I can't believe this happened. So they take all the information from him, which is basically nothing, and they go back to the house, where they run it down for Fancy, and it's pretty clear that they like the guy.
Yeah.
At one point, Simone says... You would like the guy to take more bullets for his wife and kid. And it's like, given the whole story, it turns out he should have. Because, you know, there's some more stinky business. But, I mean, you don't know the situation. That'd be a fucked up thing to say if the guy could not have done anything.
Yeah. For the time being, it kind of comes off as like an asshole move. But, because you don't know what he did and didn't do to help that child, you know?
Yeah, and if it turned out to be some sort of, like, revenge thing against him, so they killed his family, like, that'd be a really messed up thing to say. I think the quote is, you would have liked to see him take one or two more bullets, which is like, I mean, if he may not have been his choice.
Yeah, I mean, if it was my kid, I hope I, same thing too, you know, but then at the same time, like, you have no idea.
To run down the rest of Sipowicz and Simone's story, because it's not really the main story. The main story has to deal with Fancy. At least that's what he gets the title of the episode.
You would consider that the main story?
I mean, I think the title implies it is. It has the ending of the episode, too.
Fair enough. I just thought that one was so boring.
Yeah, that's why I feel like a lot of this episode really isn't extremely interesting.
I felt like they were just trying to give Fancy something. You know how every now and then, like, Fancy has these small little side stories?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like they got, like, a bunch of, like, test screening back, and they were told by, like, the heads of ABC, like, hey, people really like when Fancy's involved. And so they tried to give, like, more of a Fancy story, but it wasn't that good.
and they can't really put him on cases because that's not his job. So they have
to, like... Yeah, you can't interchange him like you can with the detectives, you know? Like, I just kind of felt like it was them just trying to force-feed us some fancy stuff.
It always has to deal with, like, fancy's past. But just to run through the Sipowicz and Simone storyline, they say they're going to bring in the mother-in-law, and I think... Call me crazy, but I think the mother-in-law was kind of, like, the worst part of the entire story. She just comes in to let them know that the husband, who is still alive, is taking money off of an accident, saying that he got hurt by this, like, a city bus or something.
Yeah.
He does lottery all day while his wife has two jobs and their son was sick, and she's upset that they died while her son-in-law did not.
She's basically every mother-in-law. She doesn't really like her, her son. I mean, that's not true. Some mother-in-laws like their son, their son-in-laws, whatever. But, and she kind of ties that whole story together. Her emotions kind of tie everything together. They need to talk to her. She kind of has this, like, breakdown. Screams, like, you know, take me, not the kid, and blah, blah, blah. And it's supposed to be what makes you feel for, like... It's supposed to be the emotional, like, driving force for this story. And she, I think, is a bad enough actress that it hurts it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought, too. Because she comes She comes in and they're like, hey, so what do you think of Paul? And just from moment one, where she's like, he had a hole in his heart! He's like, you mean Paul? No, my Joshua. He's like, that lazy, he's no good. He's like, this is Paul. Like, it's also confusing because, like, they're trying to get the information out of her. And when Sipowicz gets a water bottle and puts some water in a cup and gives it to Simone to give to her, like, it felt like kind of a, here, give her some water, she's done acting for the day, not, like, console her.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't feel like a very good scene.
No, not at all.
So, all they learn is that he's kind of a dick from the mother-in-law. They run him through BCI, and it turns out he's clean, but they check the phone records, and he's been calling a strip club a lot, and while they're going over that with Fancy, Vince Catelli shows up.
Vince Catelli, baby.
And he's in good spirits. He's feeling good. He's all, you know, he's all smiles and finger guns.
Ticker's working.
Yeah, he's talking about how if you have any reservations about getting the heart surgery, don't. He's never felt better. Turns out he's running claims for insurance, and the dude tried to put in an insurance claim for his wife before her body was cold.
That's weird. Like, okay, so, like, I know it's a TV show, but, like, people do that in real life, like...
Oh, yeah.
That's weird, right?
It's very weird.
Yeah.
I watched a thing on Stephen Colbert. Not Stephen Colbert. That's not even close. John Oliver. It's a different guy with glasses that used to be on The Daily Show.
You're so racist, Kirk.
Look, I can't tell these white males apart. But he did this thing about how hard it is to get, like, death certificates in this country, and how, like, the business of death has become crazy in America. There was, like, a half a moment where I was like, maybe he's doing this because he knows how complicated it gets. Because, like, to file a death claim, you have to, like, get a death certificate. It has to be notarized and then confirmed, and then that takes months of paperwork. And I was like, for, like, half a second, I was like, he just did this because he knows it's going to be a goddamn shit show. And if he can get it started while in the hospital, then it's less to worry about later. Of course, that isn't the case.
No, not at all. Not at all. And that's why, like, that's what they try to, I think, set up with his, like, character and, like, have when he's talking to them. I think they try to show that he's not that great of a guy that way, too.
When he shows up to the house, because he had heard that they got the case for the double homicide, he asks them, he's like, do you suspect foul play? And Sipowicz says, double homicide, always a high likelihood. And then he's like, well, the reason I ask is because of how quick he's submitting the paperwork. And he said, but the call was anonymous. And I was like, can people anonymously call to file for life insurance? Like, that doesn't work.
If you have all of the, like, information, I don't know, but I feel like if you had all of the information, you might be able to, like, call and just be like, hey, I want to get, like, the paperwork started on this. This number, this, this, and this. Get it going. And they'd be like, who's calling? And you're just like, oh, I'm calling on behalf of so-and-so. I want to remain anonymous. I don't know, maybe you can do something like that.
Because, yeah, that was the other thing that, like, kind of bothered me was just the idea that Vince is like, well, I'm investigating because it seems fishy, but it wasn't him. It's like, then who the fuck was it? Who the fuck could have done that for him from the hospital?
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't even think at all about that.
Because it was like, oh, yeah, it was called an anonymous. Be like, can you do that? Because then why would you take it seriously? Because then couldn't I just call in a random person I know if I know who their life insurance is with? But it's, you know, just me overthinking. They mentioned to him they're going to see if there's a second woman by going to the strip club that he's been calling. And Vince asked...
Wait, real quick. Did Vince say that they filed a claim or that someone called to try and start a claim?
I think that they filed it.
Okay.
I think. I mean, I watched the episode...
I have a feeling if it was more of like... I'm going to have to go rewatch it later, but like... If they said something along, if he said something along the lines of like, oh, someone was trying to like start this filing process of this claim, and then they were like, oh, what is it? Like, let's get going, and then the person was like, well, I want to stay anonymous, and then they're like had to break it down. I don't know.
They mentioned that they have to go down to the Cotton Club, which is a strip club. Well, they said they have to go to a strip club, and then Vince asked which one.
Isn't that where Vince got in trouble or got picked up after he got in some trouble? Was that a strip club?
That wasn't a strip club. He had some heart difficulty at a strip club when he shot at some guys who were trying to rob it. But he was picked up at a regular bar. I know that Vince just asking is hilarious. Sipowicz just straight up asked him, oh, did you ever frequent that place? And that ends the conversation with them.
Okay. Andy does the same shit all the time when they talk about bars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Someone will be like, hey, we gotta go to this bar on 5th. And Andy will be like, which one? And they'll like, and then they'll say it, and he'll be like, oh, I know that joint. It's like, so, like, I don't know. It's this Andy, again, razzing someone for the same shit he's about.
But there weren't any titties on display at his bar. He waited to go back with his hooker named Dolores.
He also, in other episodes when they were, like, in strip clubs, he used to talk about how he would be there.
Yeah, he also has a comment in the next
episode. Comment about how he would have applied to be, like...
The pole cleaner.
I forgot what the job was, but, like, some, like, gross-ass job at the strip club.
The guy who cleans the pole. He says it next episode. There's two episodes in a row that have to do with strip clubs. And just a reminder to everybody, Vince used to work at that station... Until he got drunk and stole a bus. Wasn't arrested, though. He just stopped working there.
No charges. Just was asked to retire.
Which he was upset because he didn't get his full 20 years. Anyway, let's move on.
Mm-hmm. All he had to do was retire. And he's like getting paid to not be at work and not in jail.
And he got an easier job with an insurance company.
Yeah. And I think he probably still had insurance through the police union that probably paid for his surgery as well.
Yep.
So it's like the dude made out like gravy after like doing something that me and you did it, we'd be like put in jail for years.
100%. After
Maybe not years, we're white. Maybe not years.
We'd be out for a couple months with good behavior. Well, when they go to the strip club, they go up to the guy behind the bar, and I don't know why, but he looked so much like poor man Sean Astin, I had to write it down.
poor day for that guy.
Poor man Sean Astin.
Sean Astin is kind of already the poor himself. So.
I'm sorry, he was Samwise Gamgee. He's a part of one of the most beloved trilogies in all of nerddom, so... Watch yourself.
I'm with you on that, but go rewatch those. He's not killing it, so to say.
Okay, well, I mean, we don't have time to talk about them because they were literally all day in terms of movie. But I did rewatch the extended editions of those movies. He killed it, but it's fine. It's fine.
Oh my god, he does not kill it.
Dude, everybody kills it in those movies.
He is surrounded by great acting, so I think his. Horrible performance gets lost.
Okay. Alright. We disagree. Sipowicz and Simone go to the strip club and they go up to the bartender and they ask where the owner of the bar is and he gets on the phone to call and Simone pulls a straight up Batman move where he just rips the cord out and he's like, what did we say?
Yeah.
And then the guy...
Sometimes Simone, like, just teeters on this line of, like, what did you really do before you, like, became a cop? When you were growing up, like it would be interesting if there was, like, to find out, like, his, like, more about his childhood. Because he seems like he was, could be kind of a badass.
He was just kicking ass and taking names.
Like, if he didn't become a cop, he would definitely be, like, somebody that Sipowicz is hunting. Like, he would have been a mob guy that Sipowicz was trying to catch.
Or he'd be, like, Omar of NYPD Blue.
Something. He would be some badass, like, but he would be leading people, and he would be, like, Stringer Bell and Avon to certain people, where he would be, because, like, he just, everyone seems to like him, so it wouldn't matter what side he chose, good or bad, some people would still rally behind him, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, I feel like it would have been interesting to see, because he does some things that make you question, like, who he was before a cop.
He does some pretty badass things. That's why he's the Batman of these detectives. But also Kirkendall is there. That's kind of important, but not really. They burst into the back room.
So do you think he was doing it for them titties?
Doing what for them titties?
Just being tough, ripping things out the wall.
No. Dude, he's got the Russells back at home.
Okay, but...
He's got the Russells, so when he gets done, she can look into his eyes and goes, "We made a baby." Which is just boner fuel. They go into the back room where there's like a camera. There's like a camera on a bed set up, and they start grilling the woman. And they just give her nothing but the business about what she's doing, why Paul Angelos is calling her, and in all honesty, they treat her like
They don't like read her rights or anything. You know what I mean? Like they don't let her know what's going on. They just kind of like are in her face, ready to go.
They treat her like she's selling drugs when it's a strip club, which are still legal. As far as I understand.
But Kirk, this was during a time when strip clubs were just nothing but shady activity hubs.
Shady activity hubs.
Yeah, it's where...
SAHs.
Like, when you watch The Sopranos, the mob owns strip clubs in New York. It's where all the shady shit happens, dude.
Because they go in and they start grilling her, and she's like, "Have I done something illegal?" And he goes, and Simone is like, "Well, do you want us to look harder?" She gives up that Paul has been calling. They've had a thing going on. And he's like, "Well, what else?" And she's like, "Have I not been cooperative?" And he's like, "You haven't been giving us much information." She brings up a guy named Fran Watkins, who was kicked out recently for bringing a gun to the strip club, and says that he's been hanging out with Paul quite a bit. And Paul was mentioning that his family situation could change. You know, putting two and two together.
Getting rid of that baby and that wife for that stripper thing.
Yeah, we don't need the responsibilities. We need that stripper vagine. So the funniest part of this scene is as Sipowicz and Simone and Kirkendall a little bit are grilling her, there's strippers on the other side of a window.
Yeah.
And at one point, a stripper's butt is just basically pressed right at Sipowicz, and he bangs on the window and says, "Don't point that at me."
Which, this also took me by surprise. A female in charge of the strip club, in charge of a strip club in the, like, late 90s, early 2000s. Doesn't that seem kind of weird?
What's also weird is, I thought I recognized this lady who played this. Okay. And I thought she did a fairly good job acting or whatever. When I looked her up, she was not really in a lot of stuff, kind of a character actress in a bunch of TV shows. They have her acting reel up there, and this scene is in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of, like, the big scenes in it, like, the big meaty scenes. And I was like, oh, wow, I mean, that's kind of interesting that you're like, well, I did such a good job, this is one of the scenes that's going to be in my sizzle reel.
One time when Maria was doing thing for school... It was a project, and she was helping someone cast someone to play, like, a mother character. And so, like, she was looking at, like, a bunch of headshots and stuff, and then one night she, like, is like, "Hey, come check this out." And, like, this girl had sent them their reel, like, through, like, an email, and there was, like, a bunch of videos on it. And the first thing she leads with is a scene that she was in NYPD Blue.
See, it's a magnet for talent. Except for that mother character.
I mean, that's the only thing she did, but, like, that was, like, her biggest thing was being... And, like, when we get to the scene, I'll bring it up again and remind the story. It's not till later in the years. I think it's the last season, actually. Yeah, it was just interesting. Like, you know, what if that is your biggest thing?
Well, I mean, NYPD Blue was a big show.
And, at the time, it was considered one of the biggest shows. So for you to get on it, it's kind of like, oh, shit, you're on the biggest show in the world. I don't know. That's interesting.
So they got all the information about Fran Watkins, Paul kind of saying that his family situation might change. As they leave, Kirkendall, I guess to be a bitch, she asked, did Paul have a specialty? The lady's like, why? Because why would he be hanging out with me? And she said, yeah, he likes to get wet. He likes to be urinated on. And Sipowicz says, why not? It saves you a trip to the can. That's
it. Dude's a genius. It's brilliant. It does. It does save you a trip.
So I just found the note. This woman, who was the owner of the strip club, actually played Sean's mom in Boy Meets World.
Oh, okay.
That's why I recognized her. I couldn't figure it out. Then I wrote it in the last bit of the notes on this scene. Yeah, she played Sean's mom in Boy Meets World, the one that fucking bailed, if you remember Sean's story at all.
Anyways, this isn't Boy Meets World balls.
No, it isn't. Boy Meets World balls.
This isn't Topanga balls.
This isn't Mr. Feeney balls. So Fran Watkins gets pulled in. That's another famous face. It's Mark Pellegrino. You know him from other episodes of NYPD Blue, The Big Lebowski, and Lost. He was Jacob on Lost.
Oh, yeah.
He's brought in, and he's acting dumb, like he doesn't know what they're talking about, pretending he's never heard of the name Paul Angelos. Sipowicz and Simone go hard on this guy after he plays stupid for too long. And they're saying that Paul gave him up in the other room. At one point, it looks like Simone is going to hit him because he said a mother and a two-year-old boy because he's not taking it seriously.
They don't fuck around when it comes to kids.
And they said, he's giving you up and we're going to the other room to make sure of it. And it says, give you a bucket of water to cool down your brain from all that thinking.
Sipowicz and him have a really good rapport with each other when it comes to talking shit.
And they did a good job, especially in later seasons, like, playing off each other, where, like, uh-huh. one guy's gonna go hard, the other guy's gonna play it soft, or where uh-huh. they know when to escalate or bring it back. At least it's written that way. The next scene about these characters, Vince is taking a shit.
Yeah.
And, they're told by Vince that Paul's willing to take a polygraph test for the insurance claim, and they're gonna have Jill pretend to be a polygraph examiner.
Okay. Fast forward, like, okay, get through it.
Okay, so they run a fake polygraph where Jill asks him questions, and then he runs down the story, and then they, because when anytime you do a polygraph test, they have to ask questions that are, like, obvious questions to make sure they get a baseline.
You gotta set up a baseline, Kirk.
Yeah, so then they have him run down what happened, and then they reestablish that baseline later with other questions, and then they ask him, do you pay what's-her-name, which I didn't write down the name of the woman who owns the strip club. They ask,
Corey McPoorface.
Do you solicit to get peed on? And he freaks out, saying none of this is admissible in court, and Vince says, I never understood the pleasure in that.
So, okay.
All right, where are you at?
Okay, so two things popped in my brain. First thing, most important thing. Does that mean Vince Catelli has tried that and it just wasn't his jam?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's what I definitely assume. 100% I assume that he's tried to have someone pee on him and he just wasn't down for it. Is there some kind of law against setting up a fake polygraph test? Like, I feel like that evidence can't be used in court legally.
Well, polygraph testing can't be used in court legally anyway.
Oh, it can't.
That's why it makes no sense. The dude is like, hey, I'll take a polygraph test to prove I don't know anything about my wife's murder to the insurance company. But then when they bring in this information that makes him look bad, he stands up and says, I'm done with this. It'll never be used in court anyway because it's inadmissible.
But why is that dude even, like, Like, why would the insurance need... I feel like this dude's missing something. Like, why would the insurance need a polygraph test?
They wouldn't. They just did that to get him in the room.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was assuming as well, and I was like, then this guy's missing something.
That guy doesn't think that Vince Catelli and the insurance company are working with the police at all. So when they set up the polygraph thing, he's like, okay, so this is just to get that, to get my money from the insurance. I'll just do
that. Got it. I remember. I forgot that part of the dialogue.
And then once they tip the scale to let him know, by the way, we know about your bullshit, then he freaks out and says, well, none of this is admissible anyway. And they're all like, well, that's fine, but what about Fran Watkins? What about this? What about that?
Got it.
And he basically admits to paying Fran Watkins, but says he tried to stop him. I don't understand how he thinks that gets him off at all.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know how you can admit to, like, hiring someone to do all that and then try to find a way to get out of it.
And that's also the end of that story. We don't come back to them at all in the rest of the episode. The other investigation that's going on is Russell, Medavoy, and Martinez. They get an assault at a, I guess, a talent agency. A guy that represents musicians. When they get it from Fancy before he goes on his adventure with his friend from the past. And I don't know if you were... I wasn't insulted. I was just kind of shocked at this opening scene when they go to the crime scene. Because Russell, Medavoy, and Martinez show up, and they ask the uniform officer, how is the guy that was assaulted? And the guy said, he's a JFK. To imply that, like, his head is split open and his brains are on the floor in there.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, that's kind of...
Is it too soon?
Not that it's too soon, that just seems, like, kind of shitty. Is
it too soon for some JFK humor?
Eric Volper is the victim. His skull was caved in the bathroom. The person who called the police was Patricia Bell, who was a NYPD Blue alum. I don't remember the name, but I believe she is another PAA at one point.
Yes.
I don't remember that person's name. She's not a very popular one. She's kind of a bitch, from what I remember. And she was a bitch in this. She called it in after a guy named John told her, who has mild OCD and is freaking out that he found him and might be implicated. Patricia says that Eric was a dick, and everybody always had a problem with him, and he wasn't very nice to anybody. And I did write down the name of her character in the other NYPD Blues episode. It was Dolores.
Dolores, yes.
And she acts like a bitch when Russell asks for the entire Rolodex. She's like, well, then I'll go get the whole Rolodex. And it's like, well...
Yeah, she's got a mad attitude about it.
Medavoy is amazed at how much brains and blood is on the floor of the bathroom. They openly talk about how I'm sure the family would hope he dies so he's not a vegetable. The weirdest point in the scene was after they wrap up with the deal. Well, he's not DOA yet. Well, they wrap up with the crime scene, saying that they're going to look at prints on the paper dispenser. Medavoy looks back in the mirror that has blood all over it and adjusts his tie.
Okay, so, like, why, like, is Medavoy being, like, a weirdo this whole time, or what?
Yeah. Medavoy's a bit of a weirdo. Yeah, that whole scene was strange, with the JFK talk and openly talking about how they hope a guy dies because he shouldn't be a vegetable. It's weird.
It's just a very weird scene altogether.
When they come back to the house, there's a guy there named Niles, or Nils, and Naomi makes the comment, I just like to imagine he's a hologram, because he's apparently not a very nice thing to look at. He's a walk-in claiming that he vandalized the victim's car, and he looks like, you know, your standard punk for the 90s. He's got a nose ring, he's got a face tat, before Post Malone made them cool. And he openly admits that he vandalized that dildo's car, says that he's a horrible person, and he uses people. And then says, while he did that, he did not murder him, but he would like them to put out the publicity that he could have or may have.
Yeah, because it'd be good for his band or whatever, for his image.
And then he said, also,
This is pre-Instagram, pre-influencer days, bro.
Yeah, you had to get out... You can't just hashtag possibly a murderer. You had to get the police to do it.
You can't go film in a forest full of dead people.
Oh my gosh. There's not much on that story after that. They check in a little bit here and there, where basically they say a whole lot of people hated the dude. His ex-wife moved away so that they didn't have to... she didn't have to kill him. What happens to end it is they bring in a guy who's a janitor at the station, or the office. Big guy named Dana. They bring him in because he was in a hospital for, I believe, violent behavior. They never get into why he was in the hospital.
So, are we supposed to... Is he retarded?
I think he's a little touched.
Or is he just like... Sorry, that was like the wrong way to ask it, but like...
I was very curious how that sentence ended.
Is he retarded or is he just like socially awkward?
I think he has mental difficulties that are akin to someone who would have learning disabilities or behavior issues. Because even when he comes in, like, I think it's a great interview because the second he comes in, you know something's off.
But they don't know what it is, too.
The reason they brought him in is because they could have brought in anybody to interview. But I think the reason they bring him in is because he has a history of being in the hospital for something that I think they read the, like, transcript and it was like, oh, he was involved in a violent act or this or the other.
Yeah, I think it was for violent behavior. And even, I think he talks about it in his interview.
And then he says, yeah, well, you know, because they do that thing where they interview people and they ask questions, like, right after each other to, like, get them off their game. Mm-hmm. And it really takes a turn when they bring up the hospital, and then when he tries to leave. Because he just tries to leave mid-interview. And he's like, what you don't want is me losing my temper. Russell kind of goes, okay, well, did you see Eric Volper in the bathroom when you were working there today? And then she's like, do you want to hold my hands while you talk about it? Which was a weird decision.
Yeah, because she's never done that before.
Unless it was like a rape victim or a victim, I've never seen her do that kind of shit.
But yeah, she's never done it to someone that they've thought is a suspect.
He then freely admits, yeah, I broke his head on that sink because he insulted me. When he tried to tell him, like, you don't have to do that to get the paper out, you could just do this. Called him an idiot and a toilet jockey, and I smashed his head on that sink.
Okay, so you know how, like, when we were talking about the first case earlier about, like, the mother-in-law and her acting?
Yes.
What this guy gave is what they wanted from that mother-in-law. Like, they thought, like, what was going to connect these two stories were these two people, and they couldn't, and she couldn't do it, but his story and his acting did. I just thought it was all really tied together, and it was done really well.
Yeah, and when he admits it, and then he... I don't know what switches in him, but he's like, I'll rip your hands off your wrist. And then Medavoy and Martinez slam him up against the lockers.
Yeah.
And he repeatedly says, I'm sorry. And that's the end of that story. I'm sorry.
So the next question, Kirk.
Yeah.
Retard strength?
I mean, that's something I would think. If he could rip off hands off of people's arms, that would be an example of retard strength. Or R-word strength. Or mentally challenged strength.
So then he was mentally challenged then. Is what we're thinking.
I think so. That guy is Fred Collison. No, not Fred. Frank Collison. He's been on the Twin Peaks reboot, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, The Village. He's been in a couple different things. Now, the main story, only because it has the title, but it's very quick because it just repeats itself over and over and over again. Fancy gets a visit from an old friend, a gentleman named Harvey. When they first meet...
Have you ever met a white guy named Harvey?
Well, there's Harvey Dent, but I didn't meet him.
Other than the fictional character from Batman, have you ever met...
And he's played by Billy Dee Williams in one movie.
Yeah, exactly. Have you ever met a white guy named Harvey?
No. I haven't met many Harveys at all, I don't think.
Yeah, the two people I've met with the name Harvey have been two older black gentlemen.
And this is an older black gentleman who is a musician.
Harvey Keitel. There you go.
Yeah. I remember when you met Harvey Keitel.
There you go. There's another Harvey.
Harvey visits Fancy, gives him some music. Clearly an old friend. Maybe an old family friend or something like that. And Fancy, because he's a good detective, clearly sees that something's up with him. And sees that he's in poor health. But he's got to split real quick for some odd reason and leaves the station.
Yeah, very weird. Very weird that this character just shows up, acts awkward, and then is like, I gotta bounce.
Fancy runs him down and catches him outside the precinct and sits down on a bench with him. Harvey lets him know that his kidneys are gone and he's dying. Fancy also gets out of him that Harvey drove Onis Price to a murder. Basically, he drove Onis Price to Ray Green's place. And Onis killed Ray Green and took his horn. Says that he knew about a murder, and Fancy's like, well, he can't do anything based on a rumor. And he says, well, I drove him there. And it's obviously been eating him up inside.
Also, what a fucking snitch.
Snitches get stitches even when you're dying.
What a snitch.
What a snitch ass bitch.
It's fucking Tekashi 6ix9ine right here.
Also, random to the story, I was watching it with Dad, and he just said while we were watching this episode, I think we sat on that bench, because we did sit on that bench outside that precinct in New York.
Yeah, I think we did.
Fancy gets information on Onis Price that he's in the system for drugs. He got caught with felony weight of, was it cocaine or heroin?
Doesn't matter. He should have just counted his lucky stars that Judge Dredd wasn't there when he was arrested.
No, because he's judge, jury, and executioner.
Yeah, bro.
And here's the law. Fancy tells Harvey that he's already in the system and that he's probably not going to admit to a murder. And Harvey pushes the issue, saying he just wants Onis to admit it for some reason. Fancy brings in Cohen to arrange a meeting and to get statements, and Cohen clearly doesn't care and doesn't think it's a very important thing to do.
I mean, I kind of get why Cohen thinks it's not important to do. He's probably got, like, you know, things that matter going on right now, like things that have happened in, like, this decade.
He's got some Kirk into dolls.
Yeah, but he's got shit going on, dude.
He makes a comment to the other detectives that he's going to work on a case from the Reagan administration.
Yeah, see, you can't get mad at him. Like, he's got, like, legit important shit, like, he's got to worry about. And Fancy's calling him because this dying man feels guilty he didn't do something, like, 30 years ago. Like, sorry, but that's on you, bro.
And no offense, and Fancy is doing the nice and right thing, but Fancy could have just brought in anybody to pretend to be a lawyer and set up a camera.
100%. Fancy's actually doing more than he should.
And Fancy even talked to Onis and tried to get him to, like, admit to what happened, and Onis said that
he actually drove Harvey.
And he has no idea what's going on, what happened. Then Fancy and Harvey and Cohen have their statement filmed, and Cohen is, like, trying to run it like it's a statement that matters. And Fancy is just like, let him do it how he wants.
Yeah, that's what also, like, part of this story is bullshit. It's like, it just kind of feels like everyone is just like, oh, just let him say what he wants to say so he can die with, like, not feel bad.
Yeah, it just turns into, like, a confessional.
And, like, no offense, dude, like, fuck you. Like, you should have said something earlier. You didn't, so you're gonna have to go to your deathbed with that. Peace. Like, a bummer. Sucks to be you, dude. You should have been a better human.
Sucks to be you. Now, guess what? Now Onis is still going to jail. Like,
yeah,
regardless,
Onis is still gone. Like, yeah, like nothing's gonna change.
He says he's gonna skip dialysis, which is like, okay, well, that's how you live. So I don't know why you would do that.
And yeah, like, and then he starts saying, then he starts, like, just acting childish and, like, and is like, well, I'm not doing this. It's like, motherfucker, starts acting like a baby. Anyways,
the end of the episode, him and Fancy have a heart to heart in Harvey's place. And they have a conversation about working hard to be successful versus what you're passionate about. Because Harvey has no family, but he, like, put his soul into music and ruined his body with drinking. And Fancy's like, sometimes I think I may have let the world pass me by and my kids don't know how much I love them. And then it just kind of, you know, ends.
Like, the thing that's weird is, like, I want to know is, like, who is this person to Fancy? What is the connection? Because, like, Fancy does a lot for this dude, for this dude to basically be, like, throw his hands up and walk away.
And there was also, I wrote this down because, basically, I watched this episode 3 times. When I got to this scene, I was like, yeah, the episode's over, and I stopped paying attention. But there was a line where the guy was like, well, the reason you're successful is because you were out in the fields picking, and I was dusting the piano inside the house. And I was like, whoa. Slave metaphors right now seem weird. Like, I don't know. It seemed like an odd time and an odd place to put that in. And also, what do you mean? Like, because he worked really hard to be a cop, he's successful, and you worked on your music? But fucking, you worked on your music, man. Yeah, you're thinking about your life as a whole, but it's such a
weird... Everyone has, like, a different path. Like, everyone's path is, like, just a little bit different, though.
Yeah, and to compare, like, that to, like, slavery was kind of left field-ish.
I don't get the metaphor because it's like, Fancy had a choice to either, like, play the piano or, like, become a cop, you know? And so did you. Whereas, like, the slave piano player didn't have a choice.
He didn't have a choice to do anything.
The slave in the field didn't have that choice to be in the field.
And most likely, he was doing both.
It's a weird metaphor.
Yeah, most likely he did both. Yeah. Like, so, I don't know, it seemed odd. It was odd. But then again...
It was very odd.
They were both black men, and they were using the metaphor as they wished. It just seemed... It perked up the ears.
But I also want to know, like, was this written by a white dude? Because it had the feelings of, like...
Yeah.
Really, really written by, like, white men trying to, like, solve slavery.
We're gonna solve it, boys. Then they high five.
we're gonna get them to relax about it. That's what it kind of felt like with this thing. They're like, we're gonna give them the words. When they see these words, they're just gonna chill out and just everything's gonna be cool from here on out, boys.
Hey,
we got it.
After this episode, they're gonna let us use the N word. High five, and they just.
I don't remember a lot of like. Drama TV from that time, you know, because like I was watching Boy Meets World and shit and going to bed before I could watch NYPD Blue. I don't think there was a lot of giving two black men like that much time on screen to talk and stuff, so I think that was something different on TV. But like what they were talking about just felt like they were trying so hard.
Yeah,
to like it was just very awkward.
All right, anything about this episode before we wrap it up?
I mean, the episode's fine. It's not one of the stronger episodes. It gets lost in the middle. I think there's a reason why it's like episode 6 and 7.
Yeah,
and not
it's a little...
one of the first or last episodes. It's not a whole lot going on. It doesn't contribute much.
Yeah, it's a little janky. There's not a whole lot of through line where you find out about like the overarching stories.
Like I said earlier, it would have made the story or this episode so much better if there was like, why was Fancy helping this man so intently? Like, other than this man's dying wish of, like, getting this off his chest, which, like, do you know how many of those Fancy probably gets? Like, he probably, like, there's probably tons of people who want to come in and be like, hey, I want to confess something. But this person he knew personally, and, like, who was he in his life and why? Because that was more interesting as to why Fancy was, like, going and talk. Like, he even went to, like, where this other guy was in jail and talked to him, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's a fucking boss. He doesn't have to do that.
And what's
he
also,
shouldn't have to do that.
And what's also, like, I think the moment that highlighted it the best was when they go into Harvey's place and they kind of relax, Fancy goes, I wish I had paths had crossed more often. And be like, I do too, because I don't fucking understand...
Yeah,
what's like, going like, on? Why, like he why, just showed up.
And then I had questions of why didn't they cross more often?
Like what's going on?
And if they didn't cross that often, why are you doing all of this for this man? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Like, was he a friend of your dad's? Because like I know there's like part of his dad's storyline. Like you learn a little bit about his father later on, and like. And some things about that, like, does it have something to do with that? But, like, I just wish I would have known just a little bit more about, like, why he was so important. I feel like it would have made the story better. So that, I mean, there's, like you said, there's funny one-liners, like, the guy from Lost, him and Sipowicz and Simone, their scene is interesting and it's good. The, is he retarded or is he...
Dana. Dana's the character's name.
Oh, Dan?
Dana. Because they have
a
moment.
That's right.
Because
he makes fun of him for having a female, a girl's name, or having Dana or something. I don't remember. But that guy, he was really really good in their scene, and like there were some good things in it, but it was just not as interesting as other episodes.
It's also structured so weird how Simone and Sipowicz, like the opening interrogation or conversation, isn't that great, and then it has a couple of really big downfalls. And a couple of really big spikes, but they're in such weird spots that it kind of it flows oddly.
Uh-huh.
And since we end on Fancy, and the scene before Fancy's is the end of Russell's and Medavoy's and Martinez, which we haven't been paying as much attention to, it just kind of, it's a weird, rocky structure. I think they kind of got it, I mean, I don't want to assume, but I think they got it together and they're like, this one's a little awkward, so throw it in episode 6. Throw it after some winners and before some really heavy hitters so it'll get forgotten about. Every episode of NYPD Blue Balls is on AsherBrothersPodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and where you find a podcast. We're on Instagram at Asher Brothers Podcast, Twitter at Asher Bros Pod. I am there to talk about the show, and have yourself a good one.
Thank you once again for listening to NYPD Blue Balls. If you have a moment, please rate and review the show on whatever platform you're using to listen to it. It's how the show gets seen, and more importantly, more people will watch the best show ever, NYPD Blue. If you need to find NYPD Blue, it is currently streaming on Hulu and Amazon. Every single episode, all 12 seasons, are on both of those. If you need more NYPD Blue information in your life, something to read, you're probably at home. Keep it safe. You can always check out True Blue, a book written about the first couple seasons by creators and consultants. You could check out What Would Sipowicz Do, a collection of articles written about the show. And you could also check out Gene Kendall's book, An Unofficial Guide to NYPD Blue, on Amazon. If you need more info in your life, every episode of this show will always be available on AsherBrothersPodcast.com, iTunes, well, not iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and where you find a podcast. Thanks for listening. Please keep safe, wash your hands, don't touch your face, stay 6 feet apart from other people, and have a good one, and watch more NYPD Blue.
Peace.